This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Poet Sherwin Bitsui, author of the poetry collection Shapeshift, is our guest this afternoon. He's visiting the University of Illinois to take part in the Carr Reading Series. Let me tell you a little bit about him. Also a painter, he is quoted in a publication of his alma mater, the Institute of American Indian Arts, as saying, "The image is a meeting place where the voice of the poem is as much the participant as the reader or listener is." He is originally from White Cone, Arizona, on the Navajo Reservation, and now lives in Tucson. His mother is of the Bitterwater Clan, his father from the Many Goats Clan. His honors include a poet grant from the Witter Binner Foundation of Poetry, a Truman Capote Creative Writing Fellowship, and a Whiting Writers Award. Shapeshift, published by the University of Arizona Press, is his first book. His poems have also appeared in American Poet, the Iowa Review, and elsewhere. Sherwin Bitsui will read from his poetry and talk about it today, the 28th of October, 2008, at 4:30 this afternoon in the Author's Corner of the Alana Union Bookstore. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join us with questions, comments, your thoughts. I look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Welcome. It's so nice to have you here in the studio with me.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Would you tell us more about the importance of the image in poetry? Can you talk more about this idea of the image is a meeting place where the voice of the poem is participant?
As a poet, I approach poetry and story through image. And I'm not too sure if that comes from the Navajo language, which I speak. And I somehow am drawn towards just an image as a participant, not an image as some sort of accessory, I guess. It's not there to really pummel you over the head with any sort of idea. So when I said that the image is as much a participant, I think I was trying to say that people are allowed to read the poem and draw from it whatever conclusion they want, whatever they need, whatever they feel like the poem can give them, and that they will also be able to come back to it at a later time and, you know, enact another piece of themselves, I guess, give themselves some sort of participation with the poem.
So the poet then is out of the picture?
I think I'm not necessarily out of, I don't think the poet is necessarily out of the picture. I think the images probably are more a part of the process than the poet at some point. So I think, I mean, they're still there. I mean, I'm still, the poet is still drawing up the images and creating the images. But I think in Shapeshift, I think I was more interested in just presenting these, because I think as a Native person, obviously, there's so much I could say, but then a lot of it would just sound like rhetoric, you know? I mean, would just sound like a regular speech writing. So I had to create these poems, and I had to make them, entice them with oftentimes very bizarre images, you know? But so I tried to reach it that way.
Yeah, well, now, since we've teased the audience, we should have you read a poem.
Sure.
So that people get the sense of your work.
This is a poem that is just a series of images. And it's called, I wrote this after, you know, after I had a sort of difficult time in my life. And this is called Atlas. Tonight, I draw a raven's wing inside a circle, measured a half second before it expands into a hand. I wrap its worn grip over our feet as we thrash against pine needles inside the earthen pot. He sings an elegy for handcuffs, whispers its moment of silence at the crunch of rush hour traffic, and speaks the dialect of a forklift, lifting like cedar smoke over the mesas acred to the furthest block. Two headlights flare from the blue dusk. The eyes of ravens peer at coyote biting his tail in the forklift, shaped like another reservation, another canceled check. One finger pointed at him, that one, dishwasher. He dies like this, with emergency lights blinking through the creases of his ribbon shirt. A light buzzed loud and snapped above the kitchen sink. I didn't notice the sting of the warning. Coyotes scattering headlights instead of stars. Howling dogs silenced by the thought of the moon. Constellations rattling from the atmosphere of the quivering gourd. How many Indians have stepped onto train tracks, hearing the hoofbeats of horses in the bend above the river rushing at them like a cluster of veins scrawled into words on the unmade bed. In the cave, in the backside of a lie, soldier's eye, the birth of a new atlas. One more mile, they say, one more mile.
Contrasts, there are a lot of contrasts between nature and man-made things. Would you be open to talking a little bit about that difficult time and how you came to write this poem?
I think it's in my world, in the perspective that I have, the past and the present are not necessarily separate. You know that within the Navajo perspective, time is circular, and it's always occurring. Everything's always happening. So I definitely know that when I had lost my uncle, when I had wrote this piece, I knew that it took place in a border town. And I knew that the history in this border town, a border town being a town that surrounds the reservation, and where a lot of my people go to. When I was growing up, we would go there to do laundry, and we would, you know, bring the truck and then go and get food there at the grocery store. But also, there's a lot of terrible things that happen in these towns. A lot of police brutality. Or oftentimes, a lot of people would find themselves stepping onto the train tracks, and you know, that was sort of the other history of the past. Like a lot of people would perhaps fall down and pass out on the train tracks, and these are the kind of stories I grew up with. So I always thought about history as a Native person. History is always something we're born with. You know, we are definitely never separate from it. We belong to history either as victims of oppression or as people that just were in the way of manifest destiny. So, and it was always these extremes. You know, I think when people refer to Native people, it's always either really seriously romantic, spiritual people, and then the other end is that we're sort of town vagrants, you know. So I think in that sense also the poems are extremes. The nature and but in the world also there's a real firm desire to try to mend those two places together, to try to create one poem that has these very kind of has a very kind of zigzagging effect to it. It's a poem that's also a song, I think, and it's trying to mend them and to create some sort of peace about it. There's a desire to create. In Navajo, we have a word called huzhon. And Huazhong being beauty and peace and mindfulness. That's kind of what we always try to strive for in our life, is this notion of Huazhong. And these poems are the opposite of that, but I feel like they're reaching for that.
Mm. If I'm not mistaken, the page before that poem is called 1868,
mm-hmm.
and that's it. And that was a fascinating thing for me to kind of grapple with as a reader. I wasn't quite sure, you know, what that meant, but I started to think about it, and I thought, well, it's a time of reconstruction after the Civil War. Mm-hmm. At the same time, as you mentioned, it's a period when there's further westward expansion and wars.
Mm-hmm.
That were, you know, when we think of 1868, I suppose the first thing a person from my background thinks about is Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a whole lot more happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think 1868 is a date. It, you know, Shapeshift starts off with the first poem is asterisk, and the first line is 1490-something, something mm-hmm. happened. And no one can pick it out of the lineup, you know, referring to 1492 when Columbus came, you know.
To the Americas.
To the Americas. So that's a historical date. Then the next page over is a poem that just says 1868, and it's a blank page.
Mm-hmm.
And 1868, and I was trying to think about how can I talk about this space, but, you know, it's powerful in that you actually were thinking, like, you were filling it in with your knowledge of what 1868 means. For the Navajo people, it was when we were released from Fort Sumner after several years of being it was a concentration camp, basically, is what it was. And so, you know, we had fought against the U.S. government, and we had been removed from the reservation. And these are my great grandparents, and a lot of us were murdered by, you know, the armies. So 1868 was the period where we returned, or we were released from this prison, and we're allowed to move back to the reservation. So I thought of it as a very powerful point in time, and I've actually visited Fort Sumner once, and it's a very there's no monuments there. I mean, the only monument that there is there is what the Navajo people have put there, but it's always just a very dark period, and we don't really talk about it. But it is that sense of being released from captivity.
Mm.
So it is that date for me. And it was a very quiet piece in the poem, in the
mm-hmm.
book.
Mm-hmm. That place where you said there's no monument there, except what Navajo people bring to that place, are you talking about just physically going there and being there, being present there, or are they bringing things there
Well? I think the Navajo Nation did build a little monument there, but it's, if you went there without knowing it, you wouldn't, you know, you just would see this empty field. But when people talk about this place, it's a very terrible place, a very terrible memory that we have of this place. The stories are brutal, and so many people died at this place, and along there was a what we called a long walk, and you know, stories of mothers being shot if they were giving birth, if they were slowing down the people who were walking to the camp. So it's a terrible time in our history. At the same time, I think it also is a beginning point, because I don't. I always wonder, you know, what life was like before then. And as an Navajo person, you know, living now in the 21st century, I think it's a place that if it weren't there, I definitely draw from that experience.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely am a result of the survivors, the ones who walked off. I'm definitely a descendant of those people.
Mm. Another poem in which you bring the two worlds together is called The Northern Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I would call it a prose poem. It's it's almost a little bit like a news account,
mm-hmm.
or a journal entry,
mm-hmm.
or something. You want to talk about that piece and maybe read from it or read it?
Sure. The Northern Sun is a poem that came to me after a period of intense silence, and I had I mean, I don't want to sound so morose and you know, so much that of my work comes from dark things, but the two poems I did read today were from that, and The Northern Sun definitely is about the necessity of breath and the need to move on after something terrible has happened. And my grandfather was a really big figure in my life, my paternal grandfather. And I think when he had left this world, I think I had serious questions about who I was and where I was to be. You know, my grandfather being somebody who knew stories, who knew certain ways of being that I had only tasted towards the end of his life. So I think the poem was created out of that need to reconcile my contemporary self with my with the stories that have been maintained and that have carried me this far. So this poem starts off, I find it necessary to breathe the morning air, to smell the potatoes frying and watch the ceiling smoke into soft white abalone dreadlocks. When I wake up abandoned, inscribed with never open, look into, or stash in the back seat of your car, I wear a mask made from the map of Asia. Search for me in a ravine on a cliff's edge, reaching for the sun. Find me on the hood of a car racing through the stars, on the velvet nose of a horse seeking its dead master, waiting with saddle and bridle. It is necessary to see the reflection of birds on the temporary ponds of melting snow. Grandfather, you named each mesa, sister, brother, friend, and I steered onto the pavement, not knowing that inside our houses the rain would clear and our fragrance would leap from our pores and into the canyons to be covered by crumbling black rocks. Sometimes the mud on my boot breaks over fresh carpet. The payroll forgets our names while the insects on our lips find our hidden names inscribed on their wings. And we roll through thorns to find the patterns of our loneliness scribbled on our bodies like images of dragons tattooed on rocks in a Route 66 mineral shop. And after this, you will reach to scratch your back and fill nothing but a black hole, spiraling like the agitators in an empty washing machine. You will bend backwards with your mouth pressed to the linoleum, whispering, "Sister, I need a sister." But you will not be able to reach her. And never have you knelt low enough to hear the undercurrent of a breeze lost to twilight summers. The cigarette ignites the bedsheets, and I write my last sentence. Lampshades cover me. My eyelashes wriggle in my pant pockets. Your vocabulary is like the breakfast menu of a science convention. And bricks ripple underfoot. The moon reveals her daughter for the first time in 28 days, born with fists instead of hands. A writer breaks every pen he can steal from the henhouse. Disappointed, he returns to the hospital and informs the nurses that he should be pulled from the flames immediately. He sweats, points at his right foot, and says that he regrets flying back to Earth obscenely underdressed to witness what he calls a malnourished theater eating its own legs for dinner. Is this what I deserve? A white anthropologist sitting beside me at a winter ceremony? Listen, he says, your people, they speak like weeping Mongolians. Perhaps it is because we have been staring at airplanes too long, I tell him, that our throats have turned into hollowed-out spider legs extending over the rough wings of a salivating moth who rejected its cocoon as a child, saying how ugly it made him feel to be in a bed that resembled an anchor rusting in the shadow of a feeble cloud. And this time we feel the padlock snap. Prison inmates untie their imaginations which can sometimes be seen in the high desert of Arizona. Lukewarm magma flowing through the sky at a 90-degree angle. The last time I saw the sun reflected red, I was pulling a screaming baby from a clutching drunk mother on Highway 77 at noon. As the mother bounced off the pavement, I shut the baby's eyes and kicked the dead driver's foot from the gas pedal. The rear tires spun backwards. The beer in my refrigerator still smells like bread in the morning. My mother's goosebumps continue to make me shiver when she tells me to scratch her back. The IHS doctors gave her some lotion, but it doesn't help, so we scratch and scratch and scratch. I just wanted a decent cup of coffee and a cheaper view of the Washington Monument, which loomed like a bright sunstream in a forest where the dark holds you like the wind holds you in a desert canyon. The cab driver asked if I was an American Indian, and I said no. I'm of the Bitterwater people. The glittering world, this place that we fly into where traffic lights play tag with our eyes when we lay back singeing our faces with the lights of passing freight trains. What's there but rum and coke, bottle walls standing knee-deep in confusion, and rat traps disguised as dream catchers. 5 years ago, my language hit me like soft-toothed birds reaching to pull my tongue from my mouth. I didn't know what to expect when my grandmother poured gasoline on the leaves and then fired it, saying, "This is the last time I'll ever harvest." It was the way the sunset caught her cracked lips, the way her lips folded inward, which made me realize that there were still stories within her that needed to be told. Stories of when we still wove daylight onto our bones and did not live like we do now as night people. Somewhere in here, our minds glow like fog lights. A Coke can bleeds sugar, and the eyes of a turtle oozes from a high school water fountain. Somewhere in Chinle, Arizona, a blender is surrounded and pelted with gravel and cement stones by children whose parents drift through cheap wine bottles like steam rising from the necks of hemorrhaging antelope. Frogs smell a rainstorm against a shield of ochre clouds. 2 a.m., the first flakes of ash surround a family of beetles dining in the cracks of the Hoan's fading walls. The flashlight of a policeman siphons dark waters from a spit can of an old medicine man singing the last four songs of his life. Inward, I can feel the gravel in my veins soften.
The Northern Sun, a poem in Sherwin Bitsui's book Shapeshift, his collection of poetry titled Shapeshift. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. Your questions are invited this afternoon, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. When and how was it for you when you first left the area where you grew up and you left the reservation, you left the border town area? Mm-hmm. Where did you go? You live in Tucson now. What was that experience like? How old were you? And
I actually left rather late. I had stayed with my family until I was, you know, like 21 or so. And then that's when I went to the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe and started my studies there. And again, I went to sort of a safe location. I went to a place, Santa Fe, that's very kind of Native-centric and went to a Native school. So I really wasn't going any, you know, didn't go very far. I just threw the pebble.
But
right
somehow or other, I'm guessing you got to the Washington Monument.
Yeah, and then I traveled quite a bit. Yeah. And yeah, I had all these experiences. And I think as I was, Shapeshift is a lot about leaving and returning, leaving and returning. And that these areas were extreme. I mean, I go from, I think anybody probably has this scenario. I mean, whether they come from a small town to a large city, there's definitely, they're very kind of different places. But mine was always it seems to be I would always go from invisibility to visibility. You know, I would enter the city, it'd be very invisible, and I would go home and I would see my culture around me. So I think it was extreme in that sense, and also just the perspectives, I guess, people have of Native people. I mean, there was always really bizarre questions that I would get. So, I mean, throughout my history, and I'm sure a lot of Native people share this experience, is that we're always, you know, we're always faced with extremity. You know, we're either very, very positive, the images of us are very positive, or they're very negative. I mean, and we have to deal with that, even with in our own societies, in our own cultures. And so when I first left, I think, yeah, there was a sense that I was regarded as other, but like I said, I didn't go very far until, you know, recent years, where I've experienced that, where I've experienced people coming up to me and asking me which country I'm from, you know, looking at my face, and I'm like, well, I'm from here. Oh, really? No, you're not from here. You know, you look like you're from Asia or somewhere. And so
you have the map of Asia written on your face.
So, yeah, it's interesting to be, to always seem to be tapping, you know, the American narrative on the shoulders and saying, you know, hey, there's this other episode here, there's this other history here, you know, let's look at that. So, my life certainly reflects my poetry. A lot of the poems in Shapeshift, in my new work, there's almost sort of a feverish quality to them. There seems to be this sense of going from consciousness to unconsciousness constantly, and in those two deliberate spaces, there's a song that tries to balance them and bring them back to a middle place.
There's a great urgency about these poems, I would say.
Yeah.
When and how were you drawn to poetry, and when and how did you begin to write poetry?
That's always a very interesting question. I think I spent a lot of time reading, and when I came to poetry, it was just an art form that I understood without, it wasn't mysterious to me. You know, I remember reading the first poems by Ginsberg, you know, or I found some anthology of 60s poets, and of course they're all confessional, but I just read it and I knew what they were saying, I knew what the metaphors were saying, and I just, because I think a lot of that also comes from Navajo thinking. Our language is very poetic. We already have we have a place for speakers. You know, we have a place in society for people who speak well, who speak beautifully, and those are usually the leaders. So we have a culture that emphasizes sad, and then sad being either story or speaking well. And I remember as a kid, my parents would always make me say something, you know. We'd have these family gatherings, you know, and if you go to any Navajo community during any kind of gathering, you know, everybody, it's part of the culture, is everybody has their say. So usually people say, you know, it's my turn, I will say something. And you don't just go up there and, you know, write, talk about your grocery list or anything. You actually go up there and say something that's profound. And if people agree with it, they like to hear it. They like to show their appreciation to you that, you know, you've spoke well. And I think that's something I was being pushed towards at a very young age. And I respected people who spoke very well. And so I look at poetry as an art form that deals with voice and speaking well and articulating certain unsaid spaces. Mm. So I gravitated, and so I came to poetry, and I just felt that it spoke to me. And one afternoon, one late afternoon, I remember I sat down. A friend had I always said I wanted to be a writer. I didn't know what kind of writer I was going to be. She loaned me. This is the time we had like word processors, so I had this word processor in my bedroom, in my mom's house, on the reservation, and I was looking out at the sunset. And there's a mesa to the north of my house, and I would look at it, and then I just started writing these poems, and that's really how it started. I remember, I don't know how and why I just did it. So I don't know what compels anybody to become an artist or become a writer, but that was, at that point in time, it just seemed so right, and I eventually followed it, and I got a lot of support. And I was already giving readings before I had a book out, and when my book came out, I already had an audience. So they're very fortunate that way.
Mm. Poet Sherwin Bitsui is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. If you'd like to put your headphones on, we'll take a call from a listener who's waiting for us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What you were just saying kind of touched on my question here. I am terribly ignorant of poetry and Navajo culture, I'm afraid, and I'm just wondering if there seems to be a long tradition of the oral forms of poetry or sayings and speaking. Is there much that has been written down that you would call poetry, or are any of these, as you're saying, people get up and speak and say something, is any of that recorded or very much of it, or how I found it fascinating to hear how you came to poetry, but I'm just wondering if that is a traditional art in the Navajo mm-hmm. culture.
I think it is, and it's really hard to separate the two, mm-hmm. especially. And I was talking to Leanne Howe earlier. I said it's really hard as an indigenous person or as a native speaker to really separate poetry as an academic endeavor, right? As something that is just within books mm-hmm. in our culture, because we don't have those kind of boxes for things to be, you know, put into.
Mm-hmm.
So when I go home, my grandmother might be speaking, and it's going to be very poetic. She's articulating something that if I could write it down, yeah, it would be a really nice, beautiful poem. But she just sort of does it off the cuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard, and it's also hard to communicate to my grandmother, who doesn't speak English. You know, when I say, when she asks me what I do, I would say, you know, sad be nascha, you know, which basically is saying I draw with words. And so there's that would be the difficult part, is trying to define something that comes inherent in probably in all cultures, but in our culture it's hard to separate this definition of what poetry is in the Western imagination, and try to sort of put that on top of what our definition of sad behoja or sad benasha, to try to place one template atop the other and say that it's the same thing. I mean, it's how do you do that, you know? And if there's no way for me to create, to define that in the English language also, I mean, I have trouble in between trying to define one thing in one language and trying to define the other thing in another language. So they're definitely touching on the same areas. It's definitely coming from the same source.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to say. It's really, it's just a great mystery to me. I allow it to be a mystery. But as far as your question about writing some of this down, it's an interesting thing, because there is a real oral history, there is a real oral a culture that remembers. And, you know, whenever I go home, not just one person holds all the knowledge. A lot of people hold the knowledge,
right.
And they all work together to create a narrative for perhaps a moment in time, or perhaps even like a wedding. You know, I mean, all these different people come together and they say, "This is how I remember it. This is how it's supposed to be done, mm-hmm. and this is what you do now." So everybody's helping each other. It's a very kind of democratic process,
mm-hmm.
And so that's how a story is maintained, and that's how it's recreated and created again. And some of the ceremonial songs are very poetic, but I'm not going to go into that. I think some of them might have been written down, but I don't know. Again, I don't know if that's poetry in the Western sense, you know, because I'm kind of just sitting in sort of in between space right now. I'm kind of I just want to say I don't know anything, you know, but to kind of see both sides of it, I definitely know that we all have this source of something, this mystery, and you know, great poems can transcend time, and
right.
I think that's what we all look for. I hope I answered your question.
Well, yeah, it because it just seems kind of a shame not to have at least some of that written down, I think, because as you say, a great poem transcends time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe they don't need to be written down also. You know, we have such a culture, this contemporary culture, that desires everything to be written down, and then it becomes artifact. And I think there's something about always returning to the word and being able that the story is malleable, that it can function in any time and it can be recreated,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
And it can be stored in memory as well. I think we have to trust ourselves to say that we can store poems in our memory. We can store it in our bodies, and then
right.
there's a time we can give it to somebody else,
mm-hmm.
you know. And the poem might change, the rhythm might change, you know. And I think that's ideally it'd be great if we could start doing that too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or even just make sound recordings of.
Yeah, recordings.
Way, you know, because it sounds like a terrific heritage and resource to be continued.
Yeah, yeah, and it will. It will.
Mm-hmm.
I used to always be so such a fatalist. I used to always think everything's going to end, you know, with the new century, you know. But I go back to the Raz, and I do writing workshops out there. I teach, you know, high school students poetry,
mm-hmm.
and I'm thinking like, wow, you know, this is continuous. This is not, you know, we are carrying the story forth.
Mm-hmm. Mm. That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much. And when is it you will be at the bookstore?
He will be at the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon in the Author's Corner at 4:30. That's today, the 28th of October, 2008.
All right. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Sherwin Bitsui, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He will read from his poetry and talk about it today at the Illini Union Bookstore. It is part of the Carr Reading Series. So now I'm curious. You tell your grandmother, "I draw with words."
Mm-hmm.
Does she ask you, "Tell me a drawing"?
No, I think we're able to say that. It's say Saad Be Nascha. You know, it's in the language, and we're able to say. Because a friend of mine, when I went to D.C., I read at the National Museum of the American Indian in April, and there was another Navajo guy there, and he came up to my reading, and, you know, we were trying to define poetry. We were sitting for dinner, we were sitting down, and he told me, he was trying to understand me, because my work has a sort of dark element to it. You know, there's a lot of the images, some of them are troubling. And we were talking about another poet, Lucy Tabahanzo, who's a Navajo poet. You know, she's an amazing, one of our matriarchs, I guess, for Navajo poetry. And she writes poems that are very, very beautiful, and they're all kind of based on the reservation. They're stories that people have and about each other. And every time I hear her read, I'm taken back home. You know, I'm taken back to the place where I grew up. Place of my grandparents. And so we're trying to talk about how, in a way, I'm drawing, I'm creating these images, and I'm just Saad Be Nascha. I'm drawing with these words. And that there was this other definition that some Navajo poets were trying to define poetry, and they came up with this term called Saad Be Hoja, words that create beauty. And so we're sitting there and we're like, that's not really right for your work. I mean, in a nice way, he said it. He said, you're making me think differently. And there's a lot of images to work. Mm-hmm. So that's how I came to, I can't say Saad Behlajan, because for me, that's not reserved for my work yet, or I haven't reached that point of this notion of defining myself in that space of the Hojja. But I definitely can relate to drawing, you know, creating these visual paintings, you know, and I always felt like I'm a visual artist. I always felt like no matter what I do, I create spaces of image. And so I'm not that much different than a painter and or a photographer or a filmmaker, that somehow I exist in that space.
Mm. You mentioned painting and visual images, and in my introduction I said you were also a painter, and when we sat down here in the studio this afternoon at the very outset before we went on the air, you said, I just dabble, but I've come back to it. And I said, well, one of the things I think it might be interesting to have you talk about a little bit is how these two media complement one another, do they, or are you just in a different world in each place? I can't see you as that bifurcated, you know. Now I'm a painter and now I'm a poet.
I tend to really lose language when I'm painting. I can't string together a sentence. So somehow I do forget.
So, yeah.
I forget how to speak when I'm painting. And when I'm writing, I have a little bit more control over language. Whatever comes, I really love the act of painting. I love the act of, I have this really deep love for it. But I am definitely anchored to poetry because I can't escape poetry. I can't ever just leave it. It's always there. I definitely am able to move between spaces, but they offer, you know, when I realize when I paint, I'm more conscious of light. I can see certain colors that I and spectrums that I didn't see before. So it just works on a different kind of on different senses for me, and it activates those senses. Mm. And trying to right now go write a script for a film that I've been commissioned to do. And that's a whole different process too. But throughout it all,
there's where you really have a connection.
Mm-hmm. Throughout everything, I hope that I am just telling a story. Mm. That's where I can. Yeah. Even the paintings to me are poems, and then even my poems are paintings. You know, I don't want to separate anything. That I feel like at the end of my life, I'll just say these are all stories behind me. Or this is all one big story.
Oh. You mentioned working with children and young people in schools. Do you find that kids take to your passion for poetry pretty quickly, pretty easily, or is there some resistance? And how do you reach out to those kids who are hesitant, who are really shy?
I just allow them to be as crazy and wild as they can be with words. I really try to make language pliable and available. You know, I use a lot of surrealist sort of images, and I just allow them to put a nose on a bird. You know, what will the bird smell? You know, like a human nose on a bird. Because I think a lot of times they see these poems that they're given by their teachers and they're frightening, you know, they seem so far away from them. But I just allow them to really put words where words, quote unquote, shouldn't be, and then I just give them that place. Mm. So I mean, they excite me because they're so open to it.
Yeah.
But yeah. I guess sometimes I do get, I can't write. I don't know what this means, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm like, yeah, you can. You know, you can do it.
Yeah. So. Well, there we have to leave it. We're out of time.
Uh-huh.
It's been a pleasure talking with you this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Sherwin Bitsui has been my guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. Look for his collection of poetry, Shapeshift. It is published by the University of Arizona Press. His poems have also appeared in American Poet, the Iowa Review, and elsewhere. He will read from his poetry and talk about it today, the 28th of October, 2008, at 4:30 p.m., 4:30 this afternoon in the Author's Corner of the Alana Union Bookstore. It is part of the Carr Reading Series.